Rusty Quill presents Below Decks, a thrice-forgotten deep dive. Episode 9, Everyday Resistance.
Hello and welcome to the 9th episode of Below Decks, where we dig into some of the research, questions, stories, and generally tangential, interesting things that went into making Thrice Forgotten. I'm Nemo Martin, my pronouns are they, them, and I am the creator and lead writer of the series. This episode of Below Decks is coming out after episode 9 of the podcast, Raised Aloft, and will contain spoilers for that episode, so do be warned. We saw in this last episode that Nani talks briefly about having been brought up in Bengal and then being brought to Sri Lanka by the Dutch. Gammon is revealed to be Governor Graham Peters, and the rest of the Netawansan crew make a rescue attempt. Today on Below Decks, we're going to be talking about everyday resistance, and I'm thrilled to be joined by Neera Wickramasinghe. Neera, would you introduce yourself with your pronouns and tell us a bit about what you do on the show?
Yes, hello. I'm delighted to be here. My pronouns are she and her, and I'm a historian. I'm based in the Netherlands. I've also been very happy to be the historical consultant on Thrice Forgotten, at least for some of the episodes. And I've been also interested in many of the topics that this fiction deals with, and of course writing about them in a more sort of, let's say, scholarly fashion. So I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Amazing. So jumping straight into something that is maybe quite a hard question. It's quite a complex question. While researching for this podcast, I read your book, which is called Slave and a Pelican, Colonial Service and Resistance in Sri Lanka. And one of the through lines in that research is that even the concept of the word slave is complicated in this geographic and historic location. So you mentioned complications brought about by different imperial powers like the Dutch VOC and British imperial rule, things like voluntary emancipation, repressed memory, difficulties to face the past of enslaved peoples, caste systems, burdening of enslavement with only African peoples, quite a lot of complications to the word slave. Will you give our listeners who, like me, hadn't understood the complexity of the area a brief overview of why enslavement is complicated here and in this time period?
Yes, it is indeed quite a complicated story. So the region actually I'm working on, and I think the podcast also speaks about, is the Indian Ocean. And the Indian Ocean, has been a relatively neglected and unexplored theater of the slave trade, unlike the Atlantic. Some scholars have even spoken, about the tyranny of the Atlantic and the silencing of the Indian Ocean slave trade. I think there are a number of factors that explain why it is a complicated story. I mean, unlike the Atlantic, the slave trade in the Indian Ocean world was multidirectional. So it went sort of in all kinds of different directions to different places. It changed over time. And then it also included slaves of many different origins, insofar as you can really trace the origins in a sort of scientific manner. The third aspect, I think, is that, you don't have a very sort of obvious type of slavery that dominates the enslavement in the Indian Ocean world. You have a variety of slave functions. So you can't sort of imagine the enslaved, in a particular labor situation. He can be, or she can be, working on a plantation, but could also be, a domestic, or could be a craftsperson, or could be a tailor, or all kinds of different things. So it's quite a different way of thinking about enslavement. And I think one of the ways is, of course, to avoid definition. I mean, that's also, do you really need to define enslavement? And, some scholars have spoken about a kind of a spectrum of bondage rather than slavery. And I mean, in my case, you know, I use the term slavery when the proprietors or the state, the colonial state, actually qualifies certain groups as slaves and have their status codified.
Mm.
So then it's quite obvious that you can use the term slavery. In other cases, you can speak about servitude, you can speak about bondage, and you can, rather than look at slavery per se, you sort of look at, you know, the relational aspect between particular groups in society. You try to understand, you know, what are the bonds between groups, and you look at the hierarchies of dependencies that are very evident. You mentioned caste.
Mm.
So caste is one aspect, you know, that sort of, in some ways it subsumes, it overrides slavery. So it is quite a complex situation. I can give you some other examples, but you might have some questions about more specific issues.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that you mentioned there was the idea that you use the terminology of slavery when proprietors or when you've seen it like written down, and that's the terminology given to a group of people. And I was really interested when I was reading your work about this idea you called the governmentalizing form of colonialism, where things like numbers or archives, statistics, census forms, verification certificates become this like colonial toolkit to like determine and control people's rights and their realities. So an example of that was the idea that if you didn't fill out a form, then you couldn't raise a complaint. But then to fill out the form is to then agree that the form is the bureaucratic way to go about things. But if you haven't been educated in a certain way, or like who gets to have the forms and all these kind of things, which I just found so fascinating. Will you tell us like how bureaucracy was used insidiously with things like terminology?
Yeah, I mean, it's really an interesting question, because you find that all these colonial states, you know, the reasons they actually survived, in spite of, you know, having a very small number of officials ruling them, is that they did not use pure might and force and violence to really control the colonized. So it was done in also, you know, what you call this insidious manner, which was a way of categorizing, a way of counting, a way of classifying, and creating, you know, what one scholar Nicholas Dirks has called it, an ethnographic state. So in a way, classifying and categorizing, you know, this really vast social world that they encountered when they came to these places, it was a way of controlling them.
Hmm.
And then it sort of entered into the day-to-day running of the colony. So people were counted, the, you know, forms of censuses were introduced. There were first sort of early attempts, you know, that were very peculiar and strange in some ways. But then from about the 1870s to the 1880s, you had a much more sort of so-called rational scientific way of counting people. And then what happened was that, you know, through this kind of objectification, people also began to claim entitlements based on these categories.
Mm.
So if you wanted to receive something, if you wanted to be heard, you had to also, you know, come forward using these same categories. So you had to say, okay, I'm a Burger, you know, or I'm a Tamil, a Sri Lankan Tamil, or I'm an Indian Tamil, or you had to use the categories that had been enunciated in order to get some kind of redress. So the bureaucracy was, one of the central technologies of rule, in a sense. You know, it was a way of, on the one hand, entrenching these categories, gelling them, making them understandable, making this kind of strange world that they encountered legible. And it was a form of control, you know, it was very clearly a form of control.
Mm, yeah, it really interests me. I feel like the kind of version of that we have in Trice Forgotten is that Siva is a map maker, a cartographer, and he is really interested at mapping his local community and creating this resource, which is a map of his island. Only it then turns out that information is being used to categorize and to stop a revolution and to fortify an area for the British. But I did also find it fascinating when you talk about in your book that abolitionists were also using these forms and census to basically say, if you are someone who holds slaves, you need to write that down so that we can then free those people. Like, in order to free someone, you have to write down that they are a slave.
Yeah, I think that's it's very paradoxical in a sense, you know, that like the whole movement for slavery abolition sort of in a sense made it necessary to have these figures, because in order to chart the so-called success of these attempts at gradual abolition, because all these things were tried and tested, you know, before 1832, and so in all these new crown colonies in Cape, Ceylon, Mauritius, etc. So you had these sort of new methods, you know, these new ideas that that were being tested on how to gradually abolish slavery. So they had to show, you know, in the British Parliament that it was working. Mm-hmm. In order to show, to sort of make their point and have ammunition, you know, against the people who were against abolition, they had to actually show figures. And so in order to do that, they had to create these slave registers and these registration processes, the census processes, and count people and constantly show, okay, this number of people have been emancipated, this number of children have been emancipated, all these proprietors are agreeing and they're signing these registers and registering their slaves, etc. So yeah, it's interesting how, I mean, a very sort of disciplinary process is used for a purpose that, you know, seemingly is emancipatory, you know. It's
I was going to save this question to last, but I feel like it flows like really well into that. And like, as part of this kind of like complicated language, you mentioned in your book that it's often quite hard for you as a researcher to get a figure, like a precise demographic of people in an area at the time, because there's like a blurred use of different terms, especially the use of the term black, where black is someone with dark skin. It doesn't matter what their ethnicity is, nationality or culture. And I was kind of like thinking about this research conundrum, which, as you say in the book, indexes inarticulate color prejudice, while some peoples, like you just mentioned, like Muslim Sri Lankans, were attempting to actually enshrine an ethno-religious identity in order to gain political recognition. So saying, yes, actually we should be on the census as this, which plays into the like firm, uncrossable boundaries of binary races. So on one hand, it's difficult to do research when like taxonomic ideas of race are not written down and are inarticulate and are like black and broad. And yet in the contemporary, we're trying to refuse eugenic ideas of like, you have to be one blood group in order to be categorized in a certain way. Like, how have you been balancing these ideas, or like, how do you find these are problems, or how have you been thinking about these kind of ideas?
Yeah, I mean, that's basically the challenge that researchers have when you don't accept, you know, that certain social formations exist in a sort of unproblematic way. I mean, lots of scholars don't have these issues, you know. They sort of just take it for granted that, okay, you have a group called X and another group called Y, and they've always been like that, or they might have, you know, slightly changed, but basically. So I think what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to understand, you know, how groups, how people on the one hand are racialized, or how certain communities are always in the making, and how they relate to each other. So this kind of, you know, there's this scholar, Africanist called Piers Larson, who wrote on Madagascar, and he had this lovely, I mean, the term he used was agility. You know, this kind of agility that exists when you think about communities, you know. So people are various things, you know. They don't have one single marker, obviously. And so this is something that the scholar is sort of placating on it in order to understand a particular process, you know. So I think I always try to keep that in mind, that when I'm studying an enslaved person, that this person is, well, one of that person's identity is being enslaved, but she or he might be is so many other things at the same time, you know. And it's just that my own interest in this particular aspect of his or her life is making me privilege this particular identity, but that somebody else might write this person's story you know, as a member of the fishing community, or, you know, something completely different. So,
yeah.
So I think if you keep that in mind, and you are sort of, you don't fall into the trap of being complicit in creating groups that are so solidified, and it is quite difficult, because then you are sort of floating in some kind of, you know, constant and lots of people who, you know, who read you say, okay, well, nothing seems sure, you know. Well, no, I don't think that's really a problem. I mean, you are writing about a distant past, and you have a very limited amount of information, so you have to just do whatever is possible.
Yeah, that's such a good challenge as well, constantly challenging yourself as a researcher and as a writer. I'm saying you, but I mean me, of like remembering that people are complicated. And I feel like that is also part of the reason I wrote Trice Forgotten, and I keep forgetting it, is to complicate some of the narratives that are given to us. But one of the first things you write in your book is that the individual is conspicuously absent from historiographies of the 19th century unless the subject is royal, heroic, or villainous. And I love this and your subsequent attempts throughout the book to find people despite because of the archival record of them. And I'm sure like searching for these people came with research difficulties. Like, how did you find who you did find throughout your book? And like, what problems did you find when you were searching for them?
Yes, I mean, I think, you know, in the Indian Ocean world, when you are working on subaltern groups, the turn to individual stories is kind of inevitable.
Mm.
Because, you know, unlike in the Atlantic or even the Caribbean, you don't have these, you know, these kind of revolutions, these large revolts, that yield so much more, you know, paper sort of testimonies.
Mm-hmm.
And because immediately, you know, these become sort of events, you know, so obviously they're going to be recorded, they're going to be... So I think in a sense, the fact that I turned to individual stories was somewhat... Well, it was a choice, but it was also something that, you know, I couldn't have written about rebellions, because there weren't any. And so I tried to write, you know, what I call an epic of the ordinary, you know, something that tells that, you know, ordinary lives are also so very interesting, and that these are really my heroes, you know, the fact that they resisted and they challenged the status quo in so many different ways, by running away, by, you know, going to courts, by writing petitions, or simply by remaining silent, you know, in some cases. And so finding these people, yeah, it was a kind of, I mean, there's a lot of, you know, lots of people say historians don't have any methodology, you know. I mean, so these are, of course, not historians who would admit it, but I mean, in some ways, there's a lot of, you know, serendipity. You sort of go into the archives, and then you start, you know, sifting through particular types of documents, and then you may or may not find something. But of course, there are places where, you know, somebody who has some familiarity with the archive knows where you may find information. So I looked particularly at, you know, particular records of petitions, and then I went through all these petitions, and then somehow you find references. So it's basically, yeah, there is a certain amount of luck, there is a certain amount of persistence. You have to be combing the archive. I mean, I looked at court cases, because during the early 19th century, all these enslaved people appear as, you know, either witnesses, or sometimes they are also part of a court case. They have been subjected to various, you know, acts of violence, or etc. So they appear, or sometimes they've even taken their proprietors to courts, you know. So that's the last case, I think, in one of my chapters, where this woman who actually goes to the collector, and then she files a case against her proprietor, and she says she's being ill-treated, and she's actually not enslaved at all, and she should not be kept, and that kind of thing. And she wins her freedom, you know.
Mm.
You have to sort of read these texts very, very carefully and look for clues, you know. So it's a bit like you're being a kind of a sleuth, a kind of a detective.
I was watching a seminar from one person who was saying that, like, he was attempting to find an archive for reference, and he had to go into a basement that was like waterlogged and it had snakes in it. I was like, God, that's a very intense search. And that was actually because he was having a conversation about archives, and like, he was in two minds because it was a it won't be easy for me to find where it is, but it was an Indian archive, and he was talking about this idea of, like, on one hand, he was like, wow, it would be so much easier if it was just in the British Library and I didn't have to go into this, like, dark, snake-infested thing, because there was no funding for this archive to actually be archived properly, to have the right circumstances. And yeah, he was in two minds because he was like, of course I want these archives to be in the country that they are talking about, but also the British Library has air conditioning and like a cafe, which yeah fits into all this stuff that we've talked about in previous episodes about, like, you know, colonization is still impacting how everything is researched today. But yeah, what you were talking about with magistrates, the example you gave at the end was quite surprising to me, because, like, I guess I'm used to narratives where an enslaved person could not, like, win one's freedom through going to courts and magistrates and stuff. And something I hadn't consciously thought about when writing Thrice Forgotten, but was certainly a huge factor, is a question of who these characters can go to get help. Because as is still in the present, judicial and enforcement systems are, of course, set up to protect certain peoples. And Alesti, Siva, nor Baker, they are not the kind of people who are able to go to, you know, who could they go to? The soldiers, like, who are chasing after them? Like, they are the people who determine what is justice.
Yeah.
And so you were talking about the individuals you researched when they confronted situations that took them to police stations or to law courts. They encountered collectors and magistrates who were probably also slaveholders. Can you talk more about this issue of justice and protection, and who was able to get protection, and what protection means, I guess?
Yeah, it's interesting because obviously the characters that appear in Thrice Forgotten might feel quite intimidated to go to the type of institution that appears in my books. But, you know, there are different types of institutions. So, for example, in the Indian Ocean world, when Britain began to think about the abolition of slavery, they introduced certain institutions that were specifically aimed at hearing the complaints of the enslaved against their proprietors. So in South Africa, for example, there was something called the Protector of Slaves, where people could go to complain. I mean, there was no sort of very significant action taken. But in some cases, you know, when it was like very blatant violence against a slave, etc., then the proprietors were actually taken to task and they had to answer. There were also, I mean, in Sri Lanka, for example, in the late 1820s, there was a commission of inquiry that was sent, not specifically to look into slaves or slavery, but it was to look at, like, the general situation of the island. And this became an occasion where a host of people, you know, wrote to this commission. And I mean, those are some of the petitions that I used. Well, of course, most of these people were not literate, so there were petition writers. It was actually a very lucrative form of employment, you know, where you actually wrote the petition in the right form, you know, using all the right formulas, etc. And then you translated it into either Dutch or English. And then it was put forward to send directly to the governor, because lots of people, you know, like especially subaltern people, they felt that, you know, they were at the bottom of the hierarchy, not only in terms of being colonized, but they were also at the bottom of the hierarchy in their own social system. And they would never get redress from the headman or whoever was there. So they went directly to the governor. Mm-hmm. And it was a way of, you know, sort of overriding the traditional leaders. I found that quite often, you know, they said, okay, we are paying, you know, taxes. We are paying the tax on jewelry, for example, that the colonial government has brought about. So therefore, we should get redress from this colonial government because we are taxpayers, you know. And there were also, of course, the more, you know, structural institutions like the courts of justice, during the Dutch period, what was called the Landraad, where there again you found, you know, even enslaved people appearing. And the British brought, you know, of course, the Supreme Court, but also the district courts, then the courts of the Admiralty courts also, and then the jury system that was introduced very early in Sri Lanka in, I think, the 1816 or so, you know, gave representation to different ethnic groups to sit in as juries. So I think that also brought some amount of confidence. People felt there might be some redress. Because I really felt, you know, when I was reading this material, that there was a very strong sense of what was right and wrong. You know, there was a sense of, I'll accept, you know, my condition up to a certain point, and then it's no longer okay, you know. So it's kind of this kind of metaphysical moment, you know, where you say, okay, now this is it. I'm going to try to find redress. So it's not so much, you know, a question of freedom or rights. It's more a question of justice. Mm. And I found this idea of justice is really something that is really central to the way people behave and why they at some particular moment they decide that they're going to do something about their life and try to change it.
Mm. To move slightly onto a new conversation strand, one of the characters in Thrice Forgotten, Johanna or Nani, she is one of the only characters really that I built specifically from research, because of research like yours on workers who were brought from places in India to Sri Lanka to work. Again, complicating this idea of slavery and who was enslaved in this kind of area. And you quote from James Scott, who argued that a significant aspect of maintaining relations of domination is erasing the past of a person through renaming and cutting family ties, hence why her name is Johanna. Will you tell us a little bit about what you found with, like, the naming of enslaved and serving peoples in this kind of time and geographic area?
Yes. So names also really, at the same time, they're interesting and also disappointing, you know, what you find about names. Because, as you said, one way of really destroying all kinship ties is precisely by renaming. And it's a way of making the person you know, completely isolated from any other social group. But the names, I actually used slave registers, you know, the maybe 70 or 80 books that you can find in the National Library, National Archives in London at Kew. And they have lists of names in alphabetical order and the names of the proprietors. So from 1818 to the 1830s. So I looked at all these lists, and what I found was that only about 10% of the names can be in some way identified to a place of origin or some kind of geographical place, whereas all the other names are given names. And these are, of course, you know, typical of, you know, they're not different from any other slave society, you know, so these are names of either of the proprietor or names of the month, you know, you have all these January, February, you know, and then you have some Roman names or Greek names, or so, which are obviously not, you know, can't be in any way tied up with any kind of place of origin or ethnicity or etc. But with the remaining names, I mean, the 10% of those names, I did a little exercise. I mean, it's not very scientific, but I tried to sort of locate, you know, where they would come from. And I asked many of my, you know, colleagues who work on Indonesian languages, and they it was really helpful, because some of them said, oh, this is obviously a Bugi name, or this is obviously a name from somebody from Timor, or, you know, that sort of thing. And then the Indian names were also, you know, very obvious. Of course, then it's difficult to say, are they from India, are they from Sri Lanka? You don't really know, but you do know that there was a very substantial number of people who were brought from India to Sri Lanka by the Dutch. So the chance is that they would be from India. And that's the case in Sri Lanka. In places like South Africa, you know, there's the toponym. So you have things like Isabel Fun Bengal or somebody Fun Mozambique or, you know, that sort of thing. So you can in some way identify where these people come from. And, you know, South African scholars have said, okay, out of the 60,000, you know, enslaved people who were brought to Cape from the 16th to the 18th century, a quarter came from Mozambique, a quarter from Southeast Asia, a quarter from India, and a quarter from Madagascar, yeah. But of course, it is also a little risky to say this with a lot of certitude, because sometimes then the Toppa name is actually the last port of call. So it might be that this person from Colombo or from Bengal is actually from somewhere else. So it's kind of difficult to say anything very, very definite about places of origin. And then you find these names, okay, apart from registers, you also find them sometimes in baptism certificates. So there you can identify maybe a, you know, a person who has converted from, you know, whatever their origin. It's not really said what religion they were, but generally it's to, you know, Christianity. So then their name appears in the certificate, and you can identify a name, you know, that looks like a slave name. So these are like little, yeah, ways of thinking about names. But on the whole, I think colonialism did a very good job at erasing, you know, and erasing these traces. I mean, that's one of the reasons why in the Indian Ocean world, you know, you don't have distinct identifiable communities that claim, you know, slave inheritance. And I think it's partly that reason, except in South Africa, I suppose, the Cape Malays. But other places, it's much less visible.
I had a billion questions that I wanted to ask you, but I'm so aware of time. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to allow myself to ask two final questions. So one of them hopefully is a shorter one, which is just, why were the Dutch bringing people from the Indian subcontinent to Sri Lanka instead of how we usually typically see slavery to be going to a location and enslaving local or native populations?
Yeah, I mean, the Dutch did absolutely that. I mean, they just moved people, you know, from one place to the other. So it was, that's actually the fascinating aspect of Dutch slavery. So they never enslaved the people, you know, from the place. And perhaps it was security. So you move them, you dislocate them from their environment. So Indonesians were brought to Sri Lanka, and you have many traces of, you know, Indonesian enslaved people. And then they were also taken to Cape, and then Indians were also brought to Sri Lanka. They were also taken to Cape, and Sri Lankans were taken to Cape. And then you also find a few of them in Indonesia. And then, of course, you still had, you know, Portuguese slaves that had been brought by the Portuguese to places like Goa, of African descent, who were also sometimes bought by the British and used as mercenaries, you know, in the armies and things like that. So it was kind of, yeah, all these people moving, you know, and who were moved, forcefully moved from place to place. And some of them kept their languages, but others just lost. It was just, languages were just lost, you know.
You're losing solidarity. You're losing solidarity of what land you're on. You're losing the ability to feel local. You're losing, like, familial friendship ties. But then, as we saw, people were trying to make their own new communities and trying to communicate with each other. Again, want to talk about this forever. Going to ask one final question, which is, there is a genre of enslavement narratives. I, from the outset, didn't really want Thrice Forgotten to be specifically about enslavement. Characters have enslavement in their familial or recent history, but I didn't want it to be a sort of like story about one person who is enslaved and running away or that. And you have said previously that you wanted to experiment in your book with a story-like way of writing about or narrativizing enslavement. How open question, what do we think is the best quote-unquote way to narrativize or to do justice to these people's lives, or is there any way to do that, or is it going to be complicated forever?
Yeah, I think it's a good, come back to your Thrice Forgotten, I think it's a good strategy to really embed the story of people who have some slave inheritance into a much broader story. And I think although my book, the central focus is about people who are enslaved, it's also, it's very much in context. You know, it's not a slave narrative which is disconnected from everything else that's happening. It's also a way of talking about labor relations, a way of talking about different social setting like Jaffna and the caste issues. And so I think what I tried to do was write a history through slavery and think through the lives of these individual slaves. And in each story, I was trying to address a very specific question or issue that sort of I found important for the time. So is it really the end of slave narratives? You know, I think in a way people can't really do that anymore. I mean, it's just that, you know, the way we think about the whole, you know, social beings in a different way. You know, you don't think of them simply as defined by their status, which is an imposed status. I mean, slavery it's just a status. It's not who you are really. So I think the way you narrate a story must also take those things into account. And I tried to, of course, use the example of individual lives, because I was kind of experimenting also with a way of writing that is, you know, what Sadia Hartman says, a storied articulation of ideas. You know, so you're trying to convey a certain idea, but you're also saying it in the story form. I did not try to write fiction. I did not try to invent the end of the story, because in many cases the story does not end. You know, I don't know what happens at the end, so I have to leave it unfinished. But I think it's good to think of other ways of writing history nowadays. And I don't know if my publisher would agree, though. But
I mean, I've been enjoying books like yours, and I really enjoyed, oh my God, his name,
Sujit's book. Yeah. Sujit Sivasundaran's, yes.
His book as well. I really love that as well, because it really was the idea of telling stories, and didn't seem to me, you know, as someone who's not of this heritage or culture, so, you know, empty words, but it didn't seem to me in a kind of like trauma porn kind of way. Like, it's not about centering ideas of like, look upon these poor people and watch them suffer. It was making them feel human again, and I feel like that is an important thing from my perspective. And, you know, they are in archives. Whether they're allowed to be forgotten, that's also another huge thing. But yeah, I certainly, for one, think that there is some space to explore the idea of at least telling what we know of them and putting names to them again and those kind of things, and complicating our contemporary ideas of what enslavement looked like. So yeah, who knows? Hopefully this kind of work like yours will continue to be complicated. Yeah, and I think that's a good thing. So I think that hopefully that's a good place to wrap up this episode of Below Decks. I really wanted to thank you for joining us. If people wanted to hear more from you, where can they find you and hopefully buy your book?
Yes, thank you very much. Well, I mean, if anyone is interested, my book is available with all online booksellers. It's published with Columbia University Press, but it's also available, you know, very easily. You can find it on online. And I'm not a very, you know, sort of sophisticated person on social media, but but I have made a few YouTube interventions, so you can also find me. But this is, of course, more on the contemporary issues in Sri Lanka rather than on slavery.
So yes, we will wrap up here. So that's it for me. Thank you so much from you, Neera, and we'll see you next time, Below Decks.
Thrice Forgotten is a podcast distributed by Rusty Quill and licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Sharealike 4.0 International License. The series is created by Nemo Martin and directed by Rafaela Marcus and was edited by Laurie Ann Davis and Catherine Ranella. Thrice Forgotten is produced by Ian Gears, Laurie Ann Davis, and production manager Natasha Johnston, with executive producers Alexander J. Newell and April Sumner. To subscribe, view associated materials, or join our Patreon, visit rustyquill.com. Rate and review us online. Tweet us at @TheRustyQuill. Visit us on Facebook or email us at mail@rustyquill.com. Thanks for listening.